Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Justice John Roberts ruled on its first abortion-related case today. The New Hampshire law in question requires that a parent be informed before a daughter ends her pregnancy, unless a judge grants an exception or the girl's life is at risk. The lower courts found the entire law unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, sent it back to a federal appeals court for a more narrow ruling to find out just which part of the law is unconstitutional. Jonathan Turley joins us now. He teaches law at George Washington School of Law. And Jonathan, what happened here today?
Well, that's a very good question. The case itself presented an issue of some controversy, the extent to which states must protect the health of a minor, and also the extent to which parents can be where there could be required parental notification. The court sidestepped the issue by, first of all, saying that the parties essentially agreed on the law. That is, the majority said, we have said that states can require parental notification. That remains our view. Two, we've also said that you have to protect the life and health of women and minors that are seeking abortions.
You can't put any undue burden on a woman in choosing to end a pregnancy.
Right. But the third one is sort of surprising. That is, the court said that New Hampshire had conceded that aspects of its law would violate their precedent. And so what the court said is, well, since New Hampshire had conceded the fact that their law could violate some of our past cases, we're just not going to deal with the issue of the violation, since they've already admitted it, and look only at the question of remedy.
Well, now you've got to explain further. What's the part of the law that violated the precedents?
Well, what they said was that New Hampshire had conceded that under prior cases, it would be unconstitutional to apply the act that subjects minors to a significant health risk. And so what they cite is a couple of statements in the briefs and in the oral argument where they believe that the New Hampshire lawyers conceded that critical fact.
And how would the minors be subjected to a health risk under the New Hampshire?
Well, what they're citing is the New Hampshire lawyers saying, yeah, there could be circumstances where this law is applied in a way where the requirement of parental notice would present significant health risks for a minor.
Because a parent might have been involved in the pregnancy, there might be an abusive parent, and you'd have to wait to get a judge to make the exception.
Yeah, it's primarily the issue of delay. Mm-hmm. And this is a bit of an embarrassment for the New Hampshire lawyers, because the court's essentially hanging this around their neck and saying, you conceded that critical fact, so we don't even have to look at your law. We can just focus on what the proper remedy should be. Now, what all this means is that the court did not have to readdress this question of parental notification. And in some ways, I think it's probably a political decision. The conservatives on the court would prefer for Sam Alito to be on the court before they make any major decision on abortion. The liberals on the court knew that there probably is already five justices that would go further on parental notification than past cases. So this is a rare circumstance where the left and the right preferred to have this cup, you know, pass from its lips.
So kick the football back to the appeals court.
Yes, and what we have then is a confusing decision that sort of blames the New Hampshire lawyers for making concessions and saying, you know, you took this issue out of our court because you basically conceded these facts already.
And so do we have any sense of how, and in the few seconds we have, how the appeals court will rule and when it may get back to the Supreme Court?
Well, that's a little curious, because one of the things that O'Connor said is that the legislators in New Hampshire might prefer us just to find the whole law unconstitutional than to tinker with it, and they left that to the Court of Appeals to figure out, you know, how this law could possibly be upheld in part, or whether it's better just to toss the whole thing out.
Oh, fascinating. Jonathan Turley, a professor at the George Washington School of Law, talking about the Supreme Court decision today, telling New Hampshire that they have to send the law back to the appeals court to take a look at its unconstitutionality. Jonathan, we will obviously be speaking to you again about this. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure.
Well, lawmakers on Capitol Hill are scrambling to unveil proposals to reform the lobbying industry today, now that Jack Abramoff and another lobbyist have pled guilty to influence peddling, and Republican Congressman Tom DeLay and Bob Ney have resigned their leadership posts in the wake of the scandal. House Democrats are unveiling their proposals today. Yesterday, Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert called for a total ban on privately paid travel and meals for lawmakers, but not a complete ban on gifts.
A member of Congress should be able to accept a baseball cap or a T-shirt from the proud students of a local middle school, but he or she doesn't need to be taken to lunch or dinner by Washington lobbyists.
Well, big loopholes are already being found in the reform proposals, some of which could face an uphill battle getting passed. Joining us online first from Washington is Vin Weber. He's a former Minnesota congressman turned super lobbyist whose clients include Mobile Corporation, Microsoft, and Seagram & Sons. Welcome, Vin.
Hi, nice to be with you today.
First of all, I have to ask you, in the current climate, being called a super lobbyist,
well,
do you cringe? I mean...
Well, it's not... No, I don't. I mean, it's... I've been in the business now. This is my 12th, or I guess 10th year as a lobbyist. And, you know, you understand that people have different perceptions of different professions, and the public perception of lobbying is not very good, but I have no qualms about what I do, and I guess I can tolerate that. I have to tell you, I was in Congress for 12 years, and people don't always think well of members of Congress either. So.
Well, but just tell us briefly, why do you have no qualms? What is it that you do, and why do you think it's worth doing?
First of all, the lobbying profession is basically protected by the Constitution. American citizens have a right under the Bill of Rights to petition their government. That is to go to government and seek changes in things that might affect them. What I've always told people is the right to petition a government as vast and complex as ours without hiring a professional lobbyist to help you through it is sort of like having the right to a trial by jury but not the right to hire a lawyer. Mm. Having said all that, the abuses that have come to light are real abuses. They should be corrected. People should pay a price. And the reform proposals that are coming forward are things that I support.
Well, let's take a look at some of them. For instance, the ban on travel and meals and lowering the value of gifts a lawmaker can receive from $50 to $20. Others are saying there should be an outright ban on gifts. How will that affect how you do your job?
It won't affect all of us very much. I mean, I don't, by and large, take members of Congress out to dinner. We don't sponsor trips for them. Some people do, and they will have to just stop doing that. I do think that you need to, in terms of the gift ban, you need to make something enforceable and livable. And if you know somebody sends a box of chocolate candy to a member of Congress as a Christmas gift, along with 100 other people, you don't want somebody to go to jail for that.
But. Well, would you say, let's go back to the ban on travel and dinners. Let's remind ourselves, Jack Abramoff, for instance, was able to skirt old laws by sending lawmakers on free trips,
right?
Because they were paid for by corporate sponsors, not him, his clients, not him.
Right. Well, that's exactly what needs to be tightened up, and you need to tighten up the ability of the corporation or the entity that is hiring the lobbyist to do that. If the proposal doesn't get at that, then you've created a huge loophole.
Well, today's Washington Post says there is a loophole in at least the Republican proposal. Under new rules proposed, lobbyists could still send lawmakers on trips but call them fundraisers, so that corporate clients could just hand over a check, a donation, and that would be perfectly legal. Your thoughts?
I think that they'd be better off. If they're going to do this, they ought to do it right. They ought to understand how the system works, and they ought to close that loophole. Look, I believe in professionalizing the lobbying business. I think that the days of the smoke-filled room and the back room deal should be behind us, and members of Congress should enact very tough bans that actually do what they say they're going to do, and restricting lobbyist-paid travel, whether it's paid directly by the lobbyist or indirectly by the client of the lobbyist, is something that's something we ought to do. We ought to get rid of that.
Let me ask you about a couple other proposals while we have you. The move to push the year that a legislator has to wait before becoming a lobbyist from 1 year to two. Would you have been able to wait 2 years before what's a pretty lucrative job?
I did wait 2 years.
Do you?
I think that reform is okay. I don't think it makes a great deal of difference. I have to emphasize, some of these reforms I think are substantive and meaningful. Others are more cosmetic, but even the cosmetic ones have some value if they help restore the confidence of the public in the institutions of government.
What about the ban on lobbyists from the House floor and the House gym, where we hear most of the work is done?
Yeah, I've long believed in that. I've been out of Congress now for 12 years. I've been on the floor of the House when the Congress was in session exactly three times, and each time it was at the insistence of a member of Congress who was not talking to me about business. I always felt very uncomfortable being there. I have to point out, it is illegal today under the rules of the House to lobby a member on the floor. So what we're doing is probably adding a layer of law to prevent from happening what is already illegal.
You know, you talk about law. I'm wondering, Vin Weber, what about shame? Do you think just the sheer, you know, amount of news coverage of, for instance, the Scottish golf trip that Jack Abramoff sent legislators on, how is it possible that lawmakers can now go on a trip, a golfing trip, say, spend 5 minutes talking about a topic and really tell themselves and everyone around them that they were doing, you know, educational business?
Well, they're going to get in trouble for that, and I think that you raise exactly the right question. I have to make one historic point, however. When I was in Congress in the 1980s and early 1990s, we had a similar flap, if you will, about congressional travel. The issue at that time was government-paid trips, CODELs, if you will, congressional delegations is what we call them. And the issue was, why are these lawmakers, quote, vacationing around the globe at taxpayer expense? And most people thought at that time, all right, we shouldn't do that. People don't want the taxpayers to pay for congressional travel. We'll have it privately financed. Well, now that's come full circle, and we're basically going to abolish them, and any travel by members of Congress will end up being official.
I guess the question is, how can a lawmaker look another lawmaker in the eye when they know they've done this? And do you think the image of Jack Abramoff in the fedora with the trench coat will be probably, you know, maybe even more of a force than legislation?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, in terms of cleaning up abuses in the lobbying profession and changing the way lobbyists do business, most of the change that's going to come out of this scandal has already occurred before any laws are changed. That's because people have seen Jack Abramoff is going to go to jail for 10 years. Mike Scanlon, his partner, is likely going to go to jail for some significant period of time. It could well be that members of Congress before this is over are going to go to jail. We've already seen one lose his majority leadership and another lose his committee chairmanship. The enforcement of the existing laws is probably going to produce more change in the way that the lobbying business is conducted in Washington than any of the changes that are going to come down the road.
Vin Weber, former Minnesota congressman, now a lobbyist for the consulting firm Clark & Weinstock in Washington, D.C. Vin, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And when we come back, well, the proposals are out there. We've just talked about them, but will lobbying reform pass in Congress? And will it be enforced if it passes? And does the scandal tar all parties equally, Democrat and Republican? Much more coming up here and now. Putting lobbying reform front and center as lawmakers try to control the damage from the scandal involving Jack Abramoff. He's the lobbyist who's pled guilty to bilking Indian tribes and trying to influence members of Congress with lavish overseas trips funded by clients. Democrats unveiled their reform proposals today. Yesterday, Republicans called for a ban on privately funded travel and meals. And we just spoke with lobbyist Vin Weber, who hails the reforms. But does he really represent Washington? We turn now to Larry Noble, who's executive director for the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington. And that question to you first, Larry. You know, Vin said he hails what's about to happen, what he hopes will happen. Does he really represent what's really going on in the back rooms in Washington?
Well, first, it's good to be with you, Robin. I think there are a number of lobbyists who want something done because they all feel they're being tarred by what's going on in Congress right now. And, you know, it's interesting. A number of members of Congress are trying to paint themselves as the victims, and they talk about all the bad that the lobbyists do, as if the members were forced somehow to take the trips. They were forced somehow to go to lobbyists to do fundraising. And the reality is, I think the members have a lot of responsibility in what's going on here, and there are a lot of lobbyists out there who've tried to do their job in an honorable way. Having said that, there are a lot of tools available to them that appear to give rise to buying access, appear to give rise to having an unlevel playing field for lobbyists, appear to give rise to members of Congress just doing the lobbyist bidding, and that's what a lot of the reforms are going to try to get at.
And by the way, as Vin said, there are so-called good lobbyists, or, you know, who feel that they actually are representing the American voice that doesn't get into this inner sanctum. But he's also said in the past there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats in this lobbying scandal. Is that possible with one party, the Republican Party, traditionally being closer to big business? Or do you agree?
Well, right now this scandal is focused on the Republicans. Both Republicans and Democrats have been close to lobbyists. Democrats have fundraisers that are put on by lobbyists. They accept money from lobbyists, and we look at campaign contributions, and Democrats and Republicans both get campaign contributions from a lot of the same industries. But the reality is right now, Republicans are in control of Congress. And in 94, when the Democrats were in control and there was an ethics scandal, the Democrats paid for it. So the Republicans are in control of Congress. Also, the Republicans have had what's called the K Street Project, which was this project, or is still ongoing, that is focused on really getting lobbyists and trade associations close to Republicans. And I think some of this is a fallout from that. It really broke down some of the barriers between lobbyists and members of Congress, and that was a Republican program. Also, Jack Abramoff is a Republican. So while both Republicans and Democrats have shared in getting the benefit of what lobbyists do, this scandal, I think, is being seen mainly as a Republican scandal, at least for now.
Well, let's talk about some of these proposals. As we just said with Vin Weber, lobbyists will still be able to fund lawmaker travel and meals even with the new proposals, because they can end run it by calling it fundraising and have the client just hand over a check. Now, we know that Senator John McCain has said he's aware of this loophole and he's going to try to close it. Do you think that loophole will be closed?
Well, this is an interesting one because it's actually not necessarily a loophole. And I think it's been somewhat of a misunderstanding of what this has been in some of the reports I've seen. A lobbyist can make a campaign contribution to a candidate, and it's $4,200 per election cycle to a candidate. And they can make that contribution either in a check of money, or they can pay for a fundraiser up to $4,200. They can get a bunch of their friends together to pay for the fundraiser. And so it's all a campaign contribution to the candidate, but it could be done as a fundraiser for the candidate. There are some benefits that corporations have in terms of being able to fly their executives to fundraisers, but when they fly that member to the fundraiser, it's considered a campaign contribution. They're going to take a look at this. I'm not quite sure what they're going to be able to do about it, since we do have a system that relies on campaign contributions.
What about banning these so-called earmarks in the budget? These are the special provisions that are tucked into massive spending bills, often overlooked, and they are often lobbyist-related, something that's thrown to the lobbyist so he can say, look what I got in the bill. A ban on this reform the process? It's not in the House Republicans' proposal, but Republican Congressman Jeff Flake of Arizona is pushing it.
Right, and I think what he's pushing now is actually banning them being done in committee. The argument being that they're not done on the floor, and so members don't get to vote on all of them. Earmarks are little pieces of legislation or amendments that bring home projects to districts. And a lot of members are saying that, look, this is our bread and butter. Our job is to bring things home to our district. And so I think the real reform they're talking about is making it actually part of the bill that has to be discussed on the floor. I don't know that they're really going to do that. I think right now you're not going to see a real change of the way they do earmarks, though the number of earmarks over the last 10 years has grown tremendously. And so it is a problem. I just don't think that there's the real will to do something about it, because in the end, it's bringing jobs home.
And I guess, how high does this go? Yesterday, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan declined to specify who Jack Abramoff met with at the White House. McClellan did acknowledge that Abramoff had attended several staff-level meetings. Is that common? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is a problem for the White House now. Jack Abramoff was a pioneer, and that is the designation that the Bush campaign gave to people who raised over $100,000 for the campaign. Not contributed themselves, but raised it. And he also, Jack Abramoff also gave money to the Bush campaign, which the Bush campaign has given back or is given to a charity. But they have a problem right now where Abramoff was allowed into meetings in the White House. He's a friend of Karl Rove's. And so the questions are going to continue about what did Abramoff want, what meetings was he invited into, what influence did he have on policy. The answer may be none, but I don't know that the White House is going to be able to get away with keep saying, well, we really haven't checked the records, and we're pretty sure nothing happened. I think the pressure is going to keep on until they actually explain what Abramoff was doing there. But this came up in the Clinton White House when there were arguments about certain people who had access to the White House, and I think the Bush administration is going to find itself in the same position right now.
Larry Noble, Executive Director for the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington. In the few seconds we have, just a lightning round question. Mm-hmm. Some congressmen are already saying banning privately funded travel is an overreaction. Just a few seconds to answer. Do you think these proposals will pass?
I think disclosure proposals will pass. I don't think at the end of the day they're going to ban private travel. I may be wrong about that.
Larry Noble, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we'll touch back with you. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is to spend on the war in Iraq. Well, according to a new study, the cost is heading towards the stratosphere, reaching as high as $2 trillion. That's a far cry from the numbers released by the Bush administration, about $500 billion through 2006. Some leading economists say the true cost escalates once you factor in health care for wounded veterans, wear and tear on military equipment, and the growing U.S. deficit, among other things. Joseph Stiglitz, the 2001 Nobel Prize winner in economics, and Linda Bilmes, a Harvard University lecturer and former Assistant Secretary of Commerce during the Clinton administration, co-wrote this study. And Linda joins us now from a studio at Harvard. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Can you tell us more about these hidden costs? What are some of the biggest you've found, and how did you determine that they should be included?
Well, I think that what we were trying to do was to understand what is below the tip of the iceberg in terms of cost. And there are four main categories of cost that are not included in the official estimates by either party. First is the cost of taking care of our veterans when they come home, and that includes both medical benefits and disability benefits for everyone who is fighting in Iraq now. Mm-hmm. Second are the military replacement costs. We are currently using up helicopters, Bradley fighting vehicles, and other equipment at 3 to 6 times the normal peacetime rate, and we are using them up much faster than we are replacing them. So there's the cost of actually bringing the military hardware back to the level it was before the war when this is over. Mm-hmm. A third is other kinds of defense costs which are going up, for example, the cost of recruiting. And finally, on the budgetary side, there is the cost of paying interest on the debt because we have borrowed all of the money so far to wage the war, and assuming that we continue to do so.
I'm not sure which category this other cost goes in, but you also factored the costs of a human life. Of course, there's the shattered family and friends, but for your purposes, you put a dollar figure on the life. How did you come to that?
Well, in addition to the costs that are paid by the taxpayer, we try to understand the economic cost. That's the real cost to the economy. And although it's obviously very hard to monetize the value of a life, the government does that, and the Department of Transportation and the Environmental Protection Agency have numbers. They use the figure of about $6 million to essentially estimate the economic value of a life, which means the productive capacity of a person over the course of their lifetime to the economy.
But the Pentagon only gives about $500,000 per life.
Right. I mean, the Pentagon only gives about $500,000, whereas the Department of Transportation, the EPA, and others are in the $6 million range. You can also look at the awards that were given, say, after 9/11, which ranged from $2 to $11 million per life, and the kind of range of life costs which have been given in jury awards for death and injuries and wrongful death suits, which range up to the hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm. But I think that we were trying to be conservative, and we just said if you take a kind of standard government number, which is $6 million, we use $6.1 million in our conservative case and $6.5 in our conservative case, that we try to look at what the cost, the economic cost of the loss of lives is.
Yeah. Another cost that you put in, the increase in the cost of oil at $25 billion, given that Iraq is not producing oil in the way that it was. And just a question to you. At times it reads as if you threw in everything but the kitchen sink, which brings the question, you were in a Democratic administration, the Clinton administration. You've written an op-ed piece in the LA Times questioning the need for the war. And your colleague, Joseph Stiglitz, is well known as a fierce critic of the war in Iraq. So people might wonder, did you have an agenda? Was there a little partisan piling on here?
Well, I really don't think it's a partisan issue because I feel that the Democrats are understanding the true cost of the war equally with the Republicans. The purpose of the study was simply to try and understand what the costs of the war actually are. Mm-hmm. We weren't trying to define or to estimate what the benefits of the war might be, but simply to try and understand what the costs are so that as we as a nation think about the benefits and costs, we have a true picture of what those costs are. I just want to say that we also try to be very, very conservative. For example, some people would attribute the entire increase in the oil price to the instability in Iraq and the fall in Iraqi oil production. Oil prices before we invaded Iraq were $25 a barrel, and they're now $50 or more. But we only took $5 of that increase, only 20% of mm-hmm. that increase in our study, because we wanted to be conservative, and we said we could attribute some portion of the oil price increase to the increased demand from China or the situation in Venezuela or a variety of other factors. But even just including $5 of the $25 increase, that still has a major impact on the economy.
Linda Bilmes teaches at the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. She and Nobel Economics Laureate Joseph Stiglitz co-wrote a recent study that puts the cost of the war in Iraq at almost $2 trillion. And Linda, we just have a few seconds, but as you saw that number escalate, it must have been eye-opening.
Well, it's very, very sobering to see the magnitude of that number. And as we pointed out in our article in the Los Angeles Times, to try and put that in perspective, the highest grossing film ever, Titanic, grossed $1.8 billion, which is about what we incur in Iraq in half a week.
Linda, thank you so much for doing the math. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and Linda has been speaking about the financial costs of the war. Today, we're getting a look at one of the human costs through a brief video of a kidnapped American journalist. Al Jazeera Television aired a 20-second silent video showing 28-year-old Jill Carroll, who was kidnapped in Iraq on January 7th. The network said her captors threatened to kill her if the U.S. doesn't release all female prisoners being held in Iraq over the next 72 hours. Carroll is a freelance reporter for the Boston-based Christian Science Monitor. She's worked in the Middle East since 2002. One of her colleagues, Ellen Nickmeyer, a reporter for the Washington Post in Baghdad, responded to the video on CBS Early Show today.
She looked really tired. She had really black circles under her eyes, and her hair was kind of messed up. But she looked, what struck me, and she didn't have her glasses, and she always wears her glasses. What struck me is she looked really calm and composed. I mean, she looked like she was in charge of herself.
No insurgent group has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping of Jill Carroll, but the words "The Revenge Brigade" appeared on a still photo of the video posted on Al Jazeera's website. Carroll is the first American journalist kidnapped in Iraq, one of 36 foreign journalists abducted there since 2003. You're listening to Here and Now.
Thank you.
It's estimated that over 41 million Americans belong to health clubs, plugging away on treadmills and ellipticals. Over the years, clubs have added televisions and DVD players. But what if you could also use a keyboard and a computer to check your email or surf the web while working out?
Why the heck would I want to? I'm here to relax, get away from the day, to let my mind relax and wander.
No, because I get like dizzy and like nauseous probably if I was doing it. I wouldn't be able to do it. Actually, I would. I might check my email just to see if I had an email. Yeah.
Well, now you can. Check email, write email, do research online on exercise equipment at Minnesota State University at Mankato. Wayne Sharp is director of the school's Academic Computer Center and inventor of cardio equipment computers. And Wayne, this sounds dangerous. I mean, with my luck, I would fall off.
We haven't had any deaths yet. We haven't had one person fall off, but my exercise people say that people fall off treadmills all the time, so it's not accountable to our technology.
Well, how does it work? Is this computer with keypad and everything right in the equipment?
It's attached to a post, a support post right in front of it with a swivel arm, so you can bring the computer and keyboard right up to where you can reach it comfortably and check your email. You could type letters with you on it, too. We say that you probably won't write a 30-page term paper, but you could edit it.
So the arm swings over like a dentist's chair, you know, how their tray swings over.
Very much like that. Very good analogy.
And is it, what kind of equipment? I mean, I've mentioned treadmill. What else?
We have it on elliptical machines, steppers. We have it on recumbent bikes and regular bikes. Every piece of cardio equipment that we have one of those available.
Well, now, why did you do this?
MSU is a technology campus. We have wireless, completely wireless on the campus. Mm-hmm. We have computers permeated every other aspect of the student's life, in their classroom, in the library, in the cafeterias. We thought, how could we bring technology into recreation?
Well, is this part of the, you know, we know that schools are really competing through, in many cases, their gym facilities to get students, you know, so they're going for state of the art. Is this part of it to be the, you know, just keep advancing things?
Absolutely, and we've found results with that, with students taking tours of our campus, looking, these are seniors looking to make decisions as to which college to come to. We've already had students look at our tech rec and our new auto recreation facility and say, I've just made my decision. I'm coming to MSU.
Because of what you call tech rec, technical
tech
recreation.
Technology and recreation. It's a combination of computers, technology, and recreation facilities, allowing one to exercise their mind and body simultaneously.
Now, we've seen quotes from students who said they love doing this, but we've also seen other, you know, physical therapists, trainers saying, this is exactly what I don't want. Why try to get people to come in the gym and not have their cell phone or their computer and to just focus on the training?
What we've seen as students, and this has been totally unrehearsed when we've gone up there and toured other people around, we've had students come up to the facility, get onto their exercise equipment, log into our campus network, check their email, check their notes from their instructor, their course material, and then they go to their entertainment, the TV or their radio, their DVD or CD, and continue their exercising. So this is just a small part, an addition to their exercise routine.
What do you see happening with this? How far do you think it's going to go?
Well, we think that it's going to continue. Students have a great deal of time management skills that they have to learn. And they are already sharing their times using the cell phone, walking across campus, and using that to check on what kind of grades they have. Those people that exercise all the time and don't have time to study, well, now they can study and exercise. Those people that study all the time and don't have time to exercise, now they can study while they're exercising. So it works both ways, helping the students with their time management.
Wayne Sharp, director of Minnesota State University's Academic Computer Center and inventor of cardio equipment computers, what he's calling the advent of tech rec, technology and recreation in the same machine, actually. Wayne, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Why don't we all just rent a room at the health club and live there? Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
is over. Who will be next to follow in the footsteps of Kelly, Carrie, Rubin, and Fantasia? Will Chicago bring us the next American Idol?
American Idol, that showcase of singing talent, or lack thereof, returned to television last night on the Fox network, which also resurrected Agent Jack Bauer this week in the thriller 24. Monk, the obsessive-compulsive detective, is back on the USA Network, and Dancing with the Stars returns along with its knockoff, Skating with Celebrities, which takes a slippery bow tonight. Well, you'd hardly know it was January. The first month of the year used to be a cold wasteland for television, all reruns, but no longer. In fact, as David Zurawick of the Baltimore Sun has written, the cold months have become the hot season. TV critic Zurawick joins us now from the offices of the Sun. And David, why are so many shows debuting now?
The driving force, as is the answer on almost everything connected to television, the driving force is money. And it's the economics of cable television moving into the marketplace. Cable television does not want to premiere its new shows in the fall when the broadcast networks, ABC, mm-hmm. NBC, CBS, and Fox, have all that promotional muscle and money flooding the airwaves. So they sort of program against that. And one of the dead periods for programming was really January and March. And the seasonal, while seasonal patterns aren't that, weather patterns aren't that important as they once were, they still matter. People do. You know, you don't get out after dinner. You're sitting there waiting for prime time to start for something to ease the darkness in January.
Well, some people have been waiting a long time for some of these shows, and now they're here. Let's talk about some of them. The New York Times critic says the new 24 has the power to make a grown man squeal. Do you agree?
I think with the 4 hours of 24 that we saw this week in this special package Sunday and Monday night, it is now imperative to say that 24 is the best drama on network television. If you just go with the plot and the twist and turns that these 4 hours took, it is really, and I'm a jaded viewer who has been doing this a long time, it is like the first viewing. I felt like the first time I saw North by Northwest, the Alfred Hitchcock movie. It was like being 10 years old and being a kid sitting Saturday afternoons at the movie theater.
Huh.
That's the fun of it. The other part that really, the sociology, though, of this show that makes it such an intelligent show, no other narrative, I believe, in popular culture anywhere is addressing post-911 America the way this show is.
This is, of course, 24, the, as you said, post-911 show starring Kiefer Sutherland as Agent Jack Bauer. Let's listen to a little.
At the rate you're bleeding out, you're not going to make it unless you get medical attention. You tell me what I want to know, and I will get you to a hospital. You understand me? Do you understand me?
Yeah.
4 people knew I was alive. This morning you tried to take them out. Why?
Palmer was a primary target. They only cared about Palmer. The others were just a diversion. Set you up. Make it look like you did it.
In post-911 America, that character consistently forces us to confront the question of what kind of hero is it going to take to lead us out of this situation where invasion is no longer theoretical. This guy speaks to our situation today in America the way Odysseus did for the ancient Greeks. It really does. And remember, Odysseus was a kind of bloody character.
Let's move to another show also on Fox, American Idol. Talk about switching gears. But it was the number one show last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the number one show, Robin, with viewers 18 to 49, which is the most important audience in television. It's the audience everybody wants. And it carried Fox to the first place finish ahead of CBS with viewers 18 to 49. I think it really sort of reaffirms a belief we have as a nation that merit matters. And in our everyday life, that belief is often really severely tested. So it's nice to have a show that at least creates that illusion.
Yourself. Well, HBO watchers are, of course, appalled that we're discussing American Idol, and they're counting down the days until March when The Sopranos comes back, a show that only The Sopranos could risk, you know, being away for how long?
God, it's been at least 18 months. I think it's pushing 2 years. That's one of the biggest events of the... What could be a bigger event than the return of The Sopranos for really serious fans of that show?
Do you think that it can live up to any expectations? Last season had the wrenching death of Adriana, which would seem like a really tough act to follow.
Well, you know, if you think back to the last season of Seinfeld... As it goes down to the home stretch, and you have to admit, HBO has been great in getting extra episodes, but as it goes, we have this thing as viewers, the more we love a show, a backlash sort of sets in at the end, and maybe it's our way of saying, oh, we can live without it, it wasn't so great. Remember we did this to Seinfeld? So I don't know what's going to happen down the home stretch, but this has been a terrific show. And by the way, it's the reason I don't say that 24 is the best show anywhere on television, only on network television, because I don't have to sort out and face the issue, is it better than The Sopranos?
Well, let's look at some of the regular, you know, broadcast outlets. Tom Cavanaugh from Ed, who I love, has a new show. It's called Love Monkey. You've got Ellen Burstyn in the Book of Daniel.
The Book of Daniel on NBC, which has already premiered, is an interesting show in a lot of ways. It's a series that stars Aidan Quinn as an Episcopal priest. He's got a drug problem. He takes painkillers. His whole family has a lot of problems.
And it's being protested by Christian groups.
It's being protested by Christian groups for a variety of reasons. One is its treatment of the minister played by Aidan Quinn, the priest played by Aidan Quinn, has a homosexual son. The groups are uncomfortable with the acceptance, with the implied acceptance of homosexuality, not just by the Aidan Quinn character, but also by an ongoing character with whom he carries an ongoing conversation, Jesus.
How am I supposed to tell Bishop Congreve that the mob has our money?
Well, I've always been a big believer in the truth myself.
Yeah. There has to be another way.
There's always lying.
Worked for Judas.
Listen, I think it is an intriguing series in the questions it raises about religion. Television, primetime television, has never done religion very well for a variety of reasons. But this is a quality and provocative drama that takes it on. And, you know, you mentioned Tom Cavanaugh's series on CBS that premiered this week, Love Monkey. It's a fine drama. Tom Cavanaugh is really, as you said, an engaging actor. Mm-hmm. And he plays a young independent music producer. He finds new acts and produces them for record labels in New York. And I think it's a very imaginative, or savvy at least, way of trying to speak to a young audience with a quality drama and getting a lot of music into that hour of programming. And it does. I think it's got a very good shot at success.
Smart. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Well, we're talking mid-season television with Baltimore Sun TV critic David Zurawick. And, David, we managed to do all of this without mentioning the new roller derby show. And we're not. Okay, bye.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you so much.
We're going to have a TV party tonight.
Here and Now is a production of WVUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here at